This is David's Book Talk, bringing authors and book lovers together in a unique way since 2009. Visit us at davidsbooktalk.com and join the conversation at facebook.com/davidsbooktalk. But first, pull up a chair, relax, and enjoy today's episode. Here's your host, David English.
Hello and welcome to David's Book Talk, and we have one of the biggest authors I've ever had on my show. Her name is Toni Tennille. Yes, you know her from the Captain and Tennille from the 1970s. And she has a new memoir out called Toni Tennille, A Memoir. And this is written with a relative of yours, right?
Yes, this is written with my niece, Caroline Tennille St. Clair. She is the youngest daughter of my sister, Jane. And Caroline and I have known each other, of course, since she was a baby, but actually, if anybody happened to watch our Christmas show that Daryl and I did in 1976, you will see a scene in it where Caroline, at age six, is sitting on my lap while I sing to her, "Have yourself a merry little Christmas."
Oh, that's so wonderful.
So here we are now.
Older and wiser. How did it come about you writing this book with her? I mean, how did this whole thing come about?
Well, frankly, David, I wouldn't have written the book at all if I hadn't had Caroline. You know, when you get to be my age, I'm 75 now, and, you know, you've actually had a life. You've had a long enough life that there are things to talk about, but I had never been interested in writing a memoir. And friends and fans would say, "Oh, I wish you'd write a memoir. We really like to see what your life is like." But the thing was, during that time, for the past 8 years before I came here to Florida, I was spending that time trying to figure out what I was going to do with my life. I knew I had to make a big decision regarding my husband, which I kept to myself, except for, you know, close friends and family, trying to figure out what to do. So I wasn't ready to talk about anything. But when I finally did make the decision, and people would ask me, I said, "Well, you know, I don't know if I have the discipline to write it myself." And then I thought about Caroline, because before that, she had sent me two manuscripts that she had written. One was a lovely book for children, you know, kids 8 to 12, probably. Mm-hmm. The other one was just knocked me completely on my socks, and I read all the time, and I'm always skeptical of talented relatives, but this one was incredible. And so I sent it out to all my friends. I let all my friends, you know, read it at different ages, and they all said the same thing. "Oh my God, I didn't want it to end. Oh my God, what happened to these characters?" And I thought, you know, this is a good writer. And I thought, if she and I can write this together, then I think I can do it, and I think I can tell my story. So that's how it all came about, and we started two years ago, working on it. And we finished it up once I got here to Lake Mary, Florida, in August of last year. We finished up all the final editing, the final writing, and now it's almost ready to come out. So there we are.
And I should mention it's published by Taylor Trade Publishing. I wanted to mention that earlier. I mean, just reading the memoir, and I did, and it was fascinating to read. And the very opening scene where you talk about your finger, it just amazes me how you kept that secret for all these years. And I mean, my heart just goes out to you just reading this book. I mean, with all that you've been through, I mean, you've been through an awful lot, and you're such a nice person. I mean, it's obvious just from watching you on TV, listening to your music, and I mean, I'm in awe of the way you sing and the way your heart comes out in your singing. It's just amazing.
Oh, well, you know, the ironic thing about the finger, although that really, really was it was hard for me, but I learned over the years how to hide it and distract people from looking at my hands. I think, you know, of course my family knew and some close friends knew. It's not that bad, and the ironic thing is that now my hands are terribly arthritic. Luckily, it's not the kind that hurts. It's the kind that's ugly. So my finger is the worst, the least of my problems. I'm looking at my knobby old knuckles and thinking, God, my hands look 20 years older than I am. Mm-hmm. But that's just what happens when you get older. Things like that happen.
But you're so talented. I mean, you have such a beautiful voice. I mean, I'm excited just talking to you because you were so much a part of my childhood with all that wonderful music. I mean, and I must admit, and I don't care what people think, Muskrat Love is one of my favorite songs of all time. It's just
so you're on the side of people who love it. They either love it or they loathe it. There's no middle ground anywhere there. So I'm grateful you're on the love it side.
Well, why do they loathe it? That's the question. I mean, just because it's about two muskrats, that's supposed to be...
They think it's silly and it wasn't hip. You know, Daryl and I were always considered square. And it just wasn't hip, and I think it was hip to not like it and make fun of it. But, you know, I didn't write it. It was written by Willis Allen Ramsey, a guy from Texas. So I can't, you know, they can't blame me for that part. All I did was sing it.
But it's such a beautiful song. I mean, you can't take that away from it. It's beautiful. I mean, you listen to it. I remember I had it up when I was much younger. I had it. I was listening to it in my room. My mother came through and she says, "What's this song?" You know, She just fell in love with the song and the muskrat. She was so excited to hear the muskrat. She said, "What's that sound?" And, you know, after that, she just loved the song forever.
Well, to me, it was a humorous song about two maybe Disney-esque creatures, and it was just a cute, funny song. And I actually heard it done by America. That group America recorded it first.
Oh right, I'd forgotten that.
And Daryl and I were driving to work at the Smokehouse. You know, we didn't have any hits at that time, and we were driving to the Smokehouse, which is a club we worked at in the San Fernando Valley for a couple of years before we finally had a hit record. But I always listened to the radio, Top 40, so I could see what songs maybe we should cover in our act. And I heard this song, Daryl was driving, and I heard this song, and I went, you know, Daryl, I think this is a song about two muskrats in love. I said this, but I couldn't really tell the lyrics because the lead vocal was kind of buried a little bit in their version. So the next day I went to a music store and found the sheet music. And I read the lyrics and I laughed out loud when I read them. I said, Daryl, we've got to try this out in the club. Let's work this up and see what happens. Well, the people at the Smokehouse just couldn't hear it enough. They just thought it was wonderful. In fact, I had to say, look, I'm doing it twice a night, early in the sets and then towards the end. And that's it, because they would have had us do it over and over again. So that was one of the reasons we decided to put it on our second album, was because it was so popular at the Smokehouse, we thought, well, you know, maybe other people would like it. Mm-hmm. And there you go.
Now, you're a classically trained pianist, correct?
Mm-hmm. I had 10 years of classical piano with Miss Lily Byron Gill in Montgomery.
Oh, I love to hear that. I love the way you say that.
Well, you know, I was a Southern girl. I was raised a Southern girl. So, in fact, you know, the interesting thing is I just recorded the audio book about 3 weeks ago. And as I started, of course, it starts in the South, when I was in the South, I found myself talking that way again because it just comes back. You know, when you talk about the South and you talk about the things that happened there, that's the accent I was raised with. And then as the book goes on and as I speak and I move to California, I find it going away again, like it did.
Mm-hmm.
But it, you know, it's funny. The interesting thing about that accent thing was that whenever we were doing Captain and Neil or I was doing symphonies and big bands, which I started in the 80s, whenever I was in a southern city, our band members used to tease me because the minute I would say hello to the crowd, there was the accent again.
Right.
Oh, it's so great to be back here in Alabama.
Right.
That kind of thing.
There's just something wonderful about a southern accent. I mean, to me, I mean, I've always found it so wonderfully endearing. I mean, you can't help but love that sound and love talking to somebody like that. It's almost like the British accent. I just love the British accent, too.
Well, you know, it's like the Beach Boys said in their song, and the southern girls with the way they talk, they knock me out when I'm down there.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, right.
It's funny how when you're musical, you think of everything musical. Everything relates to music in some way.
Yeah. That's exactly right. Exactly right.
So how did you decide what to put in the book and what not to put in the book?
Well, you know, there are a lot. I have a lot of life that I've lived, and I'm not sure all of it would be that interesting to other people. And what I chose to write about were the things that I felt made me the woman I am, and you know, informed the choices that I made throughout my life. I thought that maybe that's what my fans would be interested in reading about. So, and also, Caroline and I made the conscious decision to start at the beginning and do it as in a traditional format. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Rather than do it in, you know, little bits of things. This happened there and this happened there. And we tried very hard to keep the timeline, you know, the way it should be. And so that was the decision we made because we wanted people to, and I wanted people to get a sense of, you know, who I am and why I am that person.
Exactly, exactly. I'm curious how you knew that a song would work for you. I mean, Richard Carpenter said the same thing about Karen. I know you met Richard and Karen at one point.
Karen particularly. Richard was a little more reserved. I mean, Karen,
really?
Karen was reserved too, but I didn't really have any time chatting with Richard. He was always busy in the studio doing other things. So
very, very dedicated.
We were both
at A&M. Right.
Yes, we were both at A&M, you know, at that time.
She's one of the people I wish I had a chance to meet at some point. She's just one of those people that her music just really, I could really relate to, just like yours. I mean, and you know, when you relate.
What a loss. There is not another singer that sounds like Karen did to me at all. And she was one of the distinctive voices that you knew within two notes of hearing it on the radio who it was.
Mm-hmm.
So that was another thing. And, you know, although we were both, Karen and Richard and Daryl and I were both at A&M, and we shared, you know, we were on that campus there at A&M. That was the old Charlie Chaplin studios. We were in studios at different times. But every now and then, Karen and I would run into each other on the campus, because it was really kind of a campus, that particular studio thing. We would chat. You know, like you chat with somebody that you're not really close with, but, you know, just little bits about the music business. And she was shy. She was reserved. And since I was kind of shy and reserved myself, I didn't push it. I was interested, but I just felt I would give her privacy as I had always hoped people would give to me.
Yeah, that's a big thing about your book that really is intriguing, the fact that other people would pry into your lives and you know, and you had a couple people who went a little bit too far, and you really think about what being famous really is and how.
Well, we had more than just a couple of people. I just put two in there.
Oh really? There were more than that? Oh wow.
Oh, of course. And you know, and I think from my experience of what people go through today with social media, my God, I would never, ever have Taylor Swift's life or any of those people that are, you know, in the music business right now and what they have to go through. I wouldn't be able to take it.
Yeah.
I would have to just drop out. So I sympathize and empathize.
I think the honesty in social media is really disturbing too. What people will say.
Oh yeah.
I mean,
I agree. You know, I was raised as a good Southern girl in a very fine family. And, I mean, they were a loving family. Even though Daddy was an alcoholic, God knows he loved us with every fiber of his being. And we knew it. I was raised to, you know, you just don't say unpleasant things about people.
Right.
You don't. I don't do that. So when I did talk about some of the people in the book that I'm a little less than complimentary about, I held back a bit. I softened a little bit because I just didn't want to diss them. You know, a lot of these people have relatives and friends who love them and maybe don't think that they're like that. I don't know. I was a little more careful.
Right, and that certainly is understandable. And you know, in this day of pointing things out, people point things out like crazy now, especially with the political climate the way it is right now. It's just after a while, you just get, you know, enough is enough. How far do we have to go?
I agree totally.
But and the figure that I heard in the 70s, you sold about 23 million records. Is that right?
I have no idea because you know what. I didn't keep track of that sort of thing.
Right.
So one of the things you might find if you came into my charming little house that I have here in Lake Mary, Florida, you won't see any gold records on the wall. You won't see any of my career displays. You'll just see I have some nice artwork that I bought when I had money, and I have some other artwork that's, you know, just stuff I like. Life that's not expensive. I don't need that kind of stuff. I don't need to look at that. My sister Louisa has one or two of the gold records, I think. I think Jane has one, my sister Jane, and I think Melissa may have one.
You're a very giving person. Just hearing you talk about that, you seem very, very giving, like you would give anything to help other people. And that's such a wonderful, wonderful trait, excuse me.
Well, I especially for people that I love and trust and people that have, you know, the thing that's most important to me in life is the love and comfort I've gotten from my family and, oh, my God, the dear friends I've had all over the country. I mean, since I left Prescott, one of the hardest things about leaving Prescott, although I'm so glad I'm here in Florida, this is where I need to be, I had such a wonderful circle of friends. And particularly my women friends, and I called them my Council of Wise Women. Mm-hmm. And we would all get together and, you know, help each other through tough times. And they're good people. And I just have special people from my life that have been lifelong friends that are always there in my heart, whether I see them or talk to them as often as I should. They're still there.
Right.
And some of them I mentioned in the book. Some of them I mentioned.
How did you make it through 39 years with Daryl Dragon? That had to be the most horrific experience for you.
Well, the personal part was horrific. The first half of our marriage, I would say, I was still convinced that I could fix him, you know, that I could help him come out of this negative shell he'd been in all of his life, and bring him in, because I had such a loving, you know, upbringing, and he didn't. I'll have to say he did not, which you'll probably gather from the memoir.
Yeah.
He had a difficult upbringing. His family was quite different from mine, although they were incredibly talented family, just like mine was. But I thought, oh, I can fix this, you know. And The thing that was my mantra with Daryl was a poem that I learned when I was in junior high school, actually, written by a poet named Edwin Markham. And I'm going to say it to you right now because it's very short, but it explains my thinking. It's called Outwitted. And it says, "He drew a circle that shut me out. Heretic, rebel, a thing to flout. But love and I had the wit to win. We drew a circle that took him in." And that's what I thought I could do. And I wasn't, you know, I can't blame Daryl, because the things, our relationship, it was my fault, because I thought I could change him, and I couldn't. So I would say for half of our marriage, that's the position I was in.
Mm-hmm.
But the wonderful thing about being with Daryl that almost made up for the fact that, you know, romantic me didn't get what I was looking for was the music we made together and the songs that I wrote, because I was inspired by not only by my love for him, but also because of the fact that I could write a song and he could take it and make this wonderful record out of it.
Mm.
And I just thought that was the most fun thing in the world, was doing that. And another thing that I knew about Daryl that although I didn't get the emotional love that I was looking for, I always knew that he thought, number one, that I was a fantastic singer, and number two, that I was a, according to him, great songwriter. So I knew that, and that was my way of getting approval from him. And the more that I wrote and the more music we made together, the more I felt, well, you know, this makes up for the other stuff. But I was still hopeful until, you know, probably halfway through when I realized it.
And the ironic thing is that your music is so emotional, and that's what makes it so good. It's from the heart. And the,
it is.
I mean, it's all from the heart, and you hear it as you hear the song, and it conveys with people this sense of, wow, this amazing person. It is something from the depth of heart. We didn't know at the time what it really meant, what kind of a life you were living, what you were going through. We just enjoyed the music. So we're enjoying the music, not realizing the pain that you were going through.
Well, yeah, well, you know, a lot of artists have that kind of background. I can't complain. And there are a lot of people that are in what proved to be toxic marriages or relationships. And mine eventually proved to be so toxic to my spirit that I was being dragged down into the negativity that Daryl has lived in all of his life. Right. All of his life, ever since I've known him, and I know he had that problem as a child as well. And I just one day said to myself, you know, you're 73, and you're going to be dragged into a hole and you might get sick just from the stress of what you're living right now. So you have a right to have a good life. And so I made that decision and to come and I am having a really, really good, what I call the last checked box of my life, you know, where you're supposed to check your age, and there I am. I'm in the last one now, and I'm going to make the most of the life that I have left.
That's wonderful. Were there any, it really is wonderful just to hear you say that, Ed. Were there any worries about what you would reveal and what people would think, how people would judge you or when writing this book?
Oh, yeah. I knew that, you know, I don't know how many people, you know, the book is actually not going to be, it's actually officially released April 1st.
Right.
Some people have read excerpts and so forth. I would hope that when they read the entire book, they may understand my thinking, but from, and why I made the choices I made, but from the outside, I think it's very easy to judge and to come to conclusions that may not necessarily be the correct ones. And I understand why people might be confused, because it took me a long time to figure out my way forward, a long time. And so I can understand what they say. Oh, well, she was evil. She was horrible to him. Poor Daryl. No wonder she got what she deserved. You know, I've seen that stuff on social media, and then I just quit reading it because it's the trolls. They get out there and they say stuff, and they don't know what they're talking about. And mostly they're much younger than me, and they didn't know me at all in my day. You know, they didn't know me, so things changed.
Have you always been really open and friendly? I mean, has that always been your way of life?
David, let me tell you, yes, because I'm always very curious and interested in other people and their thoughts. For that reason, I'm really enjoying my Facebook page because people write to me all the time. But it takes a while, I'll have to say, for me to trust people enough to bring them into my inner life. Do you know what I'm saying?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
I don't know people's motives. Do they want to be my friend because I was a celebrity or I'm famous or whatever that is? Or do they want to be my friend just because they think I'm a fun person and we do good stuff together? It takes me a long, long time. So consequently, my circle of friends that I consider close people that I trust is small. And so when I write to people on Facebook, I'm enjoying hearing their conversations and their comments, and I'm writing back, and we're having conversations. But if they were to knock on my door, I wouldn't let them in because I don't know them.
Right.
Do you know what I'm saying?
You have to be careful. It's definitely a society now where you have to be careful of everybody. And
right.
Exactly. It's sad to say that, but it's absolutely true. And
right. And I can say, you know, for me, you know, having been a part, like, thankfully I was, of your life when you were growing up, people think they know you, and they think, you know, because I'm friendly to them when I see them in public spaces or when I'm doing, you know, a signing of an album, or in this case, book signings and that kind of thing, they think that we're really friends, but we're not, because I don't know them well enough to know why they want to be my friend.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I'm saying? And
oh,
I think,
yeah.
Like, people that are really rich are probably saying, why do they want to be my friend? It's because I'm rich and I pick up checks, which I'm not, by the way. I'm comfortable, but I can't live extravagantly by any means.
Right.
You know, I just, and I'm not a phony. I could spot a phony a mile away. And if people break my trust, they're just out of my life. That's just it.
Yeah.
I don't say anything. I just, they're gone.
Right. And that's the way it has to be. I mean, that's the way it, you know. And now, your first big record was not Love Will Keep Us Together.
Yeah. Well, The Way I Want to Touch You.
Right.
It was the first song I wrote for Daryl, ever. I wrote that when I was out on the Beach Boy tour with him, when I was playing keyboard piano for them. And I was trying to express how I felt about him in that song. And that actually became a local hit in Los Angeles on our own little label. A local DJ started playing it on his station and got all kinds of calls. Who's that group? And so we were, it's a long story, not too long to tell right now, but eventually we had our choice of four major labels. And we chose A&M, and then they decided to go with Love Will Keep Us Together for our first, you know, single off our first album. And that was a good choice, because that was what radio stations were looking for, up tempos at that time, to fill out their playlists, because their playlists were fairly ballad heavy. So that was a good choice. And then the second one was The Way I Want to Touch You. That was the second one that A&M released on their label off the album.
It begs the question, and I have to ask this question. I'm dying of curiosity here. Didn't Daryl ever say to you, I know you're writing these songs about me, and I know you're writing about our relationship, and why are you doing that? Did he ever say that to you?
No. And you know what? The funny thing was, all the love songs that I wrote, you know, even some of the ones that, you know, that go deeper and are more sensual and all that, like Deep in the Dark, and which is one of my favorites I ever wrote. But I found out later, he never read the lyrics. He didn't even care what the words said. He was only making a record, and he never listened to the lyrics. So, he didn't have a clue and didn't care.
That's amazing to me. I mean, it could have caused a lot of trouble.
I don't think so, because I was always hoping that if he had read and understood how I felt, that he might open up to it, you know?
Right.
But, of course, he never read them, and he never cared, and, you know, it was the music that's all he cared about.
Yeah, I'm so thankful for that, really. That, in a way, but like you said, it could have helped. I'm upset that didn't help, you know.
Well, he's just that kind of a person. And another thing I was thinking about as I was writing the book was that I think that I've already had people write to me on Facebook and say, well, you know, I think Daryl had Asperger's. And, you know, of course, there are going to be people psychoanalyzing Daryl. This is the person who hasn't read the book yet that wrote
right.
this comment. And I think that there are going to be a lot of people and psychoanalysts or psychologists or whatever who are going to go through and say, well, what's wrong with Daryl? This was his problem. That was his problem. Well, God bless them if they can figure it out, because I never could.
Right.
I don't know what it was. So
now, I want to talk about your acting career. You had an acting career at one point, too.
Yeah, I did. I did. It started out. I did a lot of theater, you know, and also was a member of South Coast Repertory Theater, which went on to be a Tony Award-winning regional theater. They have a gorgeous, beautiful theater that was built for them now in Costa Mesa, California, in Southern California. But at that time, it was run out of a storefront, and I took acting lessons there and did a lot of wonderful theater there. And then, of course, I wrote a musical I wrote called Mother Earth with one of the directors there, Ron Thronson, which was the first musical I ever wrote in my life. And so theater was always important to me. And then, of course, once the music career took off, I didn't do anything but little silly love boats and stuff like that. Didn't have time, and those were the ones that were offered to me, and I thought, well, this will be a nice break. But I did tour. I did the first national tour of Victor Victoria after Julie quit on Broadway and the show closed on Broadway. Mm-hmm. And I did that for, you know, a month in New York with rehearsals, and then the rest of the time was touring.
How hard was that for you to do Broadway and to do Victor Victoria? I mean, you talk about in the book how Victor Victoria was really stressful for you.
You know, the main reason, and you know, it's interesting too that some revelations came to me as I wrote the book. One of the revelations was that one of the reasons I wanted to do Victor Victoria, of course, I didn't have in mind touring. I was hoping to take over on Broadway for Julie. That didn't happen. I think I was trying to get away from Daryl for a while to get some relief from the negativity and to try to figure out what I was going to do. But the physical problem for me was that my voice is very vulnerable to allergies and smoke. Mm. And I basically, you know, I know other singers. Edie Gourmet, for example, from, you know, back in my day.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, Edie had an iron voice. She could party all night, honestly, drink, and she could go the next day and sing like an angel. Sarah Vaughan, same thing. She could do the same thing. I couldn't. The whole time I was out on Victor Victoria, I had to live like a nun because people were still smoking, you know, in restaurants then.
Oh.
And so, you know, you go and you say, where's the smoking section? Well, it's right next to where you're sitting, which is a non-smoking section. So, and mold and dust in old theaters, you know, a lot of the theaters we played were old vaudeville theaters. And they must have had dust piled up from decades up in the flies way up high. And that was just always stressful for me. There was not a day that went by that I didn't wake up and go, oh my God, is my voice there? Oh my God, am I going to make it through 8 shows a week? You know, I didn't have that kind of voice. I always dreamed of doing Broadway, but I realized after doing that, I would never have been iron-voiced enough to do Broadway. I just couldn't do it.
I wonder, with the negativity, when you're around somebody who's very, very negative like that, it tends to a lot of times cross over to you. How did you keep that at a distance, and who were your positive influence in your life?
My family and my friends, who always supported me and always said, why don't you get rid of that guy?
Yeah, exactly.
Through the whole thing. I didn't, you know, here's the thing. I protected myself as much as I could. And bless Daryl's heart, he couldn't help it. That's just his DNA.
Right.
But he just couldn't help himself. He would start out every day with a negative thought. And I think I mentioned in the book the golden hour that I tried, you know, that when we first get up in the morning, we'd see, you know, if he could go at least an hour without saying something negative. But this is a man who would go way into the wee hours of the morning listening to all the weird talk radio guys who are out there talking all the crazy things, you know, the government's going to do this and blah, blah, blah. And he just couldn't help himself. You know, I'd say, oh, isn't it a pretty day? Look at the blah, blah. And he'd go, well, you know, the government's going to steal our electricity. Then what are you going to do? So, so that didn't, the golden hour didn't work, obviously. So I basically just tried to, you know, keep a psychic distance, just kind of to put down a barrier to try to protect myself. But the thing was, I felt as our relationship went on and on and on, that I felt myself breaking a little, and I didn't want to do that.
You enjoyed making the show, the Captain and Tennille show. You enjoyed that.
Oh, I did. I loved it because, you know, I did theater all my life, and I loved it. And my mother was a television hostess, one of the first ever.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
And all of that, and my dad was a big band singer, and I just had music in my life always. And I was, yeah, I loved that part. Daryl hated it, but he was uncomfortable with it. He didn't know what to do, and I did. So when I started doing the things and singing with famous people like Ella Fitzgerald and doing sketches with Bob Hope because of television, I just thought it was the most wonderful thing in the world.
And it was, and there's no doubt about it. It was. I mean, you watch these shows, and they're enjoyable. I mean, they're just enjoyable.
Yeah, they are. They're silly sometimes, but they're fun, and I was relaxed and comfortable through all of that.
When you look at variety shows today, there aren't very many of them, other than the reality American Idol and things like that. But
yeah,
there isn't much today. I mean, Carol Burnett was one of the most fantastic.
Oh, was she not? I mean, oh my God! And we were lucky enough to be on her show a couple of times.
Oh really? Oh, that's cool.
Oh yeah. In fact, there's one video posted of Carol, Daryl, and I. Daryl mostly sat at a keyboard with his hat on and mind a couple of things, but it was Carol Burnett, Vicki Lawrence, me. I'm trying to remember who else was on. Oh, Steve Lawrence, who was a regular on their show.
Right.
And we did a long, long medley routine based on hats because of Daryl's captain's hat. And it included dancing and singing, and it was just the most fun in the world. And she was so gracious. And it's there somewhere. Maybe you can find it on my...
Oh, I'll find it.
Yeah, just go to YouTube and say Captain and Tennille, Carol Burnett Show, and see what pops up.
Where do you... Your sisters live in the area near you?
My sister Jane, who's the closest in age to me, lives a mile and a half from me. I can walk to her house.
Oh, wonderful.
And my niece Caroline lived in Orlando, downtown Orlando, with 4 chickens, 7 cats, and whatever else she has in her menagerie in her little tiny house.
Mm-hmm.
She's about 20 minutes away.
Oh, that's wonderful.
And now my sister Louisa, I talk about Louisa quite a bit in the book. She's the one who always was telling me about how square I was. Tony, don't you know that they're doing drugs here?
Right.
She still lives in Prescott. She's much younger than I am, and she has this wonderful life doing the Australian Shepherd stuff that I was doing before I left there. And then my sister Melissa, my baby sister, lives in Southern California, and I'm going to see her when we go, where Caroline and I are doing a promotional trip in Los Angeles at the end of April. And
oh, that should be fun.
That'll be fun. It'll be fun to see Melissa because I don't see her that often because she lives so far away, but it'll be fun.
And you'll probably be on some of the talk shows, I guess, or some of the morning shows.
I think so. They're putting it together right now. I do know we're doing a book signing there at Barnes & Noble, so that will be fun. I think some of my fans will come out for that.
We have fantastic memories of your music and of you, and that's something that nobody can ever take away from you and never take away from us. And that's something that everybody can hold close to their heart. I mean... Yeah, there's always going to be people who think that some of your songs were sappy. I never thought that ever. And
Well, you were naughty about, but bless you. Thank you. Some of them were silly, but so what? Some of them were very deep, and I might have gone over people's heads. I don't know.
But the thing is that many, many millions of people enjoyed your music.
Yes, they did.
And that's all that really matters in the end. I mean, that you enjoyed making it. I mean, that was your that had to be your happiest time, making music with him, if nothing else.
It was. That was my joy. And because of him, I was the most creative probably I've ever been in my life. Really.
When you first met Daryl, did you know you were going to marry him?
No. I was always very intrigued by men who were, what do I want to say, mysterious. You know, I was always thinking I was going to find the man for me. He would be You know, he would be mysterious and deep. He would, you know, he would love poetry and literature, and he would be creative in some way. And when I met Daryl, it was in San Francisco where we were doing Mother Earth, the musical I wrote with my friend Ron Johnson.
Right.
And we had, Daryl flew up to audition for me because we needed a new keyboard player. So when I walked into the theater, there he was sitting there, and he was dressed all in black. He had black hat, black, everything was black, and he had those big dark eyes, and he was kind of slumped down on a seat in the lobby. And I went, oh, this is really interesting. And then I found out he was the pianist that was going to audition for me.
Mm-hmm.
And I just felt something. I didn't know what it was. I felt that he would be really important in my life. That's all I can tell you.
Mm-hmm.
Really important in my life. And he was. Obviously, he was. I had to go through a lot of tests by him, and I talk about some of those in the book, tests that he ran me through.
Mm-hmm.
To make sure that I was, you know, the one that he was going to, I can't say have a relationship with, a personal relationship, because, you know, he had just, I mentioned in the book, I think that, that when I met him, his former girlfriend, who actually was a very well-known groupie person, had committed suicide. She had gone up into the Malibu Hills and swallowed a whole bunch of pills with a bottle of whiskey, and she was dead for 3 days before they found her.
Wow.
But she was not a girlfriend, as I later began to understand. She would call him whenever she was out on the road with some rock group or whatever, and she would, you know, she would be crying, and oh, and he would go get her and bring her back.
Right.
And so, and because it was all, it always surprised me that he was never emotional about it when he talked about it. And I thought, well, he's got it all buried deep inside. You know, I'm sure he's just destitute and horrible. He just feels horrible about what happened. But he never, He just sort of said it matter-of-factly, this is what happened. And I'm the one who said, oh, my God. And so I think he wanted to make sure that if he threw in his lot with me, that I wasn't going to be that kind of a person.
So how is Daryl today?
Daryl, you know, I talk to him about every week or 10 days. I check in with him. And he's still living in Prescott. He's living in a lovely area in Prescott, and in a what is called a cottage home there. He has people who do for him what I used to do for him, you know, feed him his health food and do all that kind of stuff. But it's so funny because every time I talk to him, I'll say, how are you? And he'll say, oh, I'm about a C-, which is what he said, you know, it's either a D-plus or a C-, ever since I've known him.
Hmm.
So we'll chat about this, that, and the other, and after a couple of minutes, it goes back to his health and his negativity about this, that, and, you know, he just is not a, he lives a very inside of himself life. The world is centered, I always think of it, as centered in his solar plexus.
Hmm.
I don't know how else to describe it. That's where he is. He hardly ever says, how are you, to me? How are things going? I'll call him up and I'll say, well, you know, and the memoir's getting ready to come out, and, just want to let you know.
Right.
People may knock on your door because people can find anybody now on the Internet.
Oh, yeah.
And I said, be prepared. He said, oh, well, I'm all fine with that. He just leads an inward life, and the outward world has not been interesting to him, except what he hears on conspiracy theory radio. That kind of thing.
Right. Now, what kind of books do you read?
Oh, my God. Oh, I read a wide variety. I have certain authors that I love for fine, you know, what I consider fine work. Right now, I am halfway through The Nightingale.
Oh, yeah.
Which is just magnificent. one of the greatest books I've read recently was All the Light We Cannot See.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Oh, my God, did that just... And there was another one called The Invisible Bridge, not the one that's the political one.
Right.
And I can't remember the name of the author, but it was about a young architect who moved to Paris, I believe it was around 1938-39, to study architecture. He was Jewish, and that was at the beginning of, you know, when all the Nazi types were turning against the Jews and all that. And that book just heartbreaking. And then, of course, I love Barbara Kingsolver. I've read a lot of her books.
Oh,
fantastic.
Yeah.
Books. And then for fun, I read Preston and Child's books, particularly the ones with Aloysius Pendergast. Because Aloysius Pendergast, who is he? He's one of my favorite types. He's kind of a nerd and a geek who chooses emotions to himself.
Right.
So that's another one I read. And of course, I've read all the Sue Grafton novels.
Oh, I love her.
To them because I love Judy Kay. She is Kenzie Milhone to me, who's the voice that reads it. I love those. And then there's another writer that I like a lot that I listen to. I discovered him. His description of things, his stories can be very violent, which I don't usually like. But James Lee Burke, do you know
him? Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Oh, my God, I love... In fact, I'm listening to one of his right now. I'm listening to it because I love the way Will Patton reads his books. They're perfect.
I just interviewed his daughter recently.
You did?
Yes.
Is she a writer, too?
Oh, yes. Alistair Burke, yes. A very, very beautiful writer.
Oh, I don't know her. I need to look into her then.
Her new book, The X, is really, really interesting. You should check that out.
Okay, I will. I will look into it, sure.
But I would recommend a book, and I don't know if you've heard of it. It's called What She Knew by Gilly McMillan.
No, I've heard of it, but I haven't read it yet.
Get it, read it. You'll love it. It is.
Okay.
It's one of those books that you will not be able to put down. And
I have so many. And you know what, David? What I'm finding now is so many books, so little time.
Exactly.
It's so true. So true. And in fact, my sister Jane and my brother-in-law Frank and I and hopefully Caroline have decided that when all of this brouhaha slows down, we are going to go, we're going to run over to Canaveral, which is a 45-minute drive from here, get on a cruise ship and take a 4-night cruise and do nothing but read.
Oh, how wonderful.
So we have time to read.
So you're in a really good place right now.
I am.
And I could not be happier for you. And I really mean that from the heart. Because from talking to you, I can tell what a nice person you are. And you can't fake that. Even talking to somebody on the phone, it's hard to fake that.
You can't fake being nice.
But some people do fake being nice and you realize they're not what they really pretend to be. But you have such a depth of emotion. I mean, and you're very. I mean, you've given me every answer I've asked for. I mean, you haven't held back at all, which is a true sign of a really good person. And
thank you, David. I really appreciate it. I really do. You've
touched my life like you have no idea, and a lot of our lives. Like you may never know the full extent of how you've touched people.
I probably won't. But you know what? All I can say is that for that I am so grateful because, you know, the way things are, you touched on it briefly, we won't go into it because it makes me crazy. The way the world is, things that are happening in the world right now, I think we all need something that gives us, you know, some joy in our memories and in our hearts while we make our way through this.
What would you say to a woman that's going through what you went through? What would you say to her? What would you advise her?
Okay. I would say, don't wait as long as I did. Don't wait as long as I did. I got help. I had a therapist, a wonderful therapist, actually in Prescott, where I lived,
mm-hmm.
who helped me make the decisions to my friends and my family. I hesitated for so long because I was worried about what the fans would think. And finally, this therapist, her name was Gudrun Miller, mm-hmm. and I'll be forever grateful to Gudrun. She finally said to me one day, she said, "Tony, you and I have been talking for this about this now and what your situation is for quite a while, and you have said to me that you don't want to hurt the fans. You don't want to disappoint the fans." She said, "This is your life. It's not their life."
Exactly.
"They will get over it. You need to do what is right for you."
And your true fans are going to be happy for you anyway, so it doesn't really matter.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
That's what they want. They want you to be happy.
Yeah, and I don't want to diss Daryl because he is what he is. I couldn't help him. I tried and tried and tried. I just couldn't do it.
Right. And that there is a point where you have to say that. You have to.
So I would say, don't wait too long. Don't wait too long. Give yourself a chance at happiness and joy.
Do you still sing at all?
You know, I did some concerts when I was in Prescott for the people of Prescott, and I did them all for free. In fact, one of them, I financed the whole thing myself.
Oh, good for you.
Really expensive.
Right.
Because I wanted, they were so wonderful to me, I wanted to, you know, give them this gift of a concert. And, oh, my God, they came out, they packed the place, and they were just wonderful. But the funny thing was that, you know, in the old days when I did concerts, you know, I had people who did this and that for me, who made sure I got, you know, the transportation and all that kind of stuff. When I finished that concert that I did in Prescott, the one concert where I had done it all, and I, you know, was in the green room with people for, you know, quite a while, signing autographs and things like that. And I walked out to get in my car to drive home, which was about a 20-minute drive from where the theater was. I there was no limo, and I went, "Oh, my God, I'm so tired. I'm never going to make it home without having an accident." So my friends, I'd forgotten. I had to drive myself home. So my friend said, "You get in the car, and we're going to be right there behind you and leading the way," because where I had to go was way out. I lived out in the rural area in Preston.
Mm-hmm.
And they followed me and led me all the way home. And I thought, you know, if I'm ever going to do this again, I'm going to have to hire myself back another personal assistant or something.
Right. I assume you're still not on the grapefruit diet.
Well, actually, I, as you know, I rather broke that diet a little earlier than Daryl did.
Yeah.
Because I couldn't stand it any longer. You know, this was one of his tests,
I
realized, and I just was starving. I was starving.
I'll bet you were. I'm starving reading the book, thinking about what you...
And he, I don't know, he just thought that was going to solve all our problems, which obviously it did not.
Right. But it's good that you're on the right diet now. You're happy. You're doing everything you really want to do. You've got a loving family and loving friends, and you're still making people happy with your records. People still listen to it. I have a Captain Nintendo disc. So.
Oh, it's wonderful. I know. You know, David, I hear so many lovely things from people, especially now that I've kind of popped my head up after having it down for 8 years.
Right, and who can blame you?
Yeah, and now to hear these things from people, it just that makes it all worthwhile.
It's being famous is people don't realize how really tough it can be.
Sometimes I would say, be careful what you wish for. You know, that was never my aim. My aim was to make wonderful music, and we just happened to be in the right place at the right time with the right music. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of wonderful singers, artists, writers, performers out there who never get that chance. We did.
Do you have any fears today?
Fears?
Yes.
Do I have fears? Well, I think probably the fears at my age is I don't ever want to get to the point where somebody has to you know, go out of their way to take care of me because I can't take care of myself.
Right.
I'm hoping when the time comes that I pass away that it's boom, gone, like a stroke or something. But I'm so damn healthy, it's probably not going to happen that way.
No.
I don't know. I don't want people to have to, you know, go out of their way to take care of me. That's the only thing I can say I have a fear of.
Right. This has been, you are just a wonderful person. And I've never spoken to you before this. I can tell people that for sure. But I just feel a warmth about it. It's been such a wonderful thrill to have done this. I want to mention again that the book's called Tony Tennille Memoir.
Uh-huh.
With your niece, Carolyn.
Caroline Tennille
St. Clair. I didn't want to forget her name. I thought, I hope I don't say her name.
Caroline St. Clair. That's right. That St. Clair was my dad's middle name.
And it'll be in all your bookstores in April.
Uh-huh. It will be. It's released officially April 1st.
And this has been David's Book Talk, and we'll talk to you next time.
You have just enjoyed the podcast of David's Book Talk, brought to you by your host, book lover David English. Please visit us at davidsbooktalk.com, follow us on Facebook and Twitter, and subscribe to our podcast. We want to hear from you, and we don't want you to miss our upcoming shows with top authors like Mary Higgins Clark, Patricia Cornwell, Lisa Scottolini, Jackie Collins, Nelson DeMille, Michael Connelly, Sue Grafton, Steve Martini, Dale Brown, David Baldacci.